So a service pack is an accumulation of a large number of changes over a 1 to 2 year interval. But problems are occurring all the time. So Microsoft's always releasing a patch, and a patch or a hotfix typically focuses in on a single problem or a small set of problems. Now, once again, in the early days of Microsoft, they would go in and they would be releasing hotfixes whenever they were available. And it got to the point where you could actually have 40 or 50 patches released over a month. Now, here's the issue. Patching is an extremely disruptive process. You have to stop business as usual. You have to coordinate with vendors. You have to test, validate, roll out, have backup plans in place, make sure everything's working correctly. Very, very disruptive to the enterprise. So if you're now going in and Microsoft's releasing 50 disruptive events a month, that's totally and completely unacceptable. You're always in a disruptive state. So Microsoft's customers went back to Microsoft. You got to give us some predictability here. You got to go in and tell us when and where and how so we can plan and make sure we're all set there. So what did Microsoft do? Microsoft released their famous or infamous Patch Tuesday. Dun, dun, dun. So the second Tuesday of every month, you know that train is coming into the station. You know Microsoft's releasing their patches, and you know that's going to be ready to go in that environment. So now, once a month, there's going to be a disruptive event, not every day or multiple times a week. So the second Tuesday of the month is when those patches are coming out. Microsoft is the only company you should ever get patches from for the operating system. You only want to get OS patches from the company that makes it. There have been third-party companies that have claimed to have more proactive patching, and most of them end up being exploits as opposed to patches and tricks for clients. So the only spot you should be getting Microsoft operating system patches from is Microsoft. However, there's one little issue. Right, wrong, or indifferent, Microsoft takes a closed disclosure view of the world, which means they will not tell you about a vulnerability until a patch is released. So Microsoft might know about a vulnerability for 1 month, 2, 3, or 4, and they will not tell you until that patch comes out, which means that puts you and your organization in a position of weakness because there could be a vulnerability. Attackers can know about it, but you can't fix it because Microsoft never told you. So therefore, we want to use third-party notification services. These are some of the free services that are out there. Typically, if you're in a large utility company, because of the criticality, you're going to go in and pay for a threat management service. These are companies where you pay money to actually go in and provide real-time threat data to you on where the exposures are within your environment. Definitely recommend that. But Eric, if there's no patch, there's nothing we can do about it. So what's the point? Oh, there's a lot you can do about it. If there's not a patch available, you might temporarily turn off the service. You might filter with a firewall. You might look for with a NIPS. You might block with an IDS. You might look for with an IDS and block with a NIPS. But there's a lot of mitigating measures you can put in place, even if you do not have a patch readily available from that vendor. So having threat sources and staying up to speed on exposures can let you proactively take alternative measures even if the patch is not available. Microsoft Update is a website that you go to in which it will scan the system and it will tell you what patches are needed, and then you could go in and select what patches you would like to deploy on your server. This is good if you want to do manual checks of systems and you want to mentally verify where they are in the patch cycle. But typically, if you're talking about your personal computers at home or you're talking about any traveling business networks, you want to go in and use Windows Update, which is automatic updating as soon as patches are available. For business systems, corporate laptops, and personal devices, Microsoft Update is very good because it's going to make sure you automatically get the patches as soon as they're available. Microsoft Update is absolutely not recommended on control systems and critical devices because guess what? You want to test, verify, and manually roll out. You don't want your devices automatically pulling patches and systems in the environment. We had one of our control system clients. They were actually a manufacturer. So it was a large-scale e-commerce company that had large-scale control systems for controlling packages, shipments, and other areas. And they called us in to help them because they had some of their control systems that were tracking, managing, and correlating inventories that were crashing. And at first, when they told us, it seemed like that they were just randomly crashing. When we started looking at it very, very closely, we realized that the systems were all crashing at the same time. When we looked even closer, we realized that the systems were all crashing once a month. And when we looked even closer, we realized that they were all crashing on the second Tuesday of the month. Turned out somebody went in and turned on Windows Update on these boxes. So when Patch Tuesday came out, they were automatically applying the patches. Most of these patches were crashing or causing issues because of the sensitivity of the application. And they literally had systems crashing once a month and they couldn't figure it out until we finally correlated it to the patch cycle. And by going in and turning off Windows Update, the system stayed up and no longer crashed. So that's sort of an example where it could get you in a lot of trouble if you're not careful there. Typically, in control system environments, we want to have centralized control. We want to have centralized third-party management solutions like your Shavlik, BigFix, or others, where we can carefully test, create patch groups, and systematically roll them out across the enterprise. We want to have corporate visibility and centrally control, manage, and test any patches that will be put in place within the environment. And absolutely, one other thing to follow up on that is when you decide to get a centralized patch management system, before you do, create a list of all vendor products that you're going to need to patch and make sure that the solution you purchase supports those vendors' products. I know that sounds obvious in a classroom setting, but I can't tell you how many times we have our clients spend millions of dollars on these centralized patch management solutions, and they only support 20% of the products in their network. And that was sort of a waste of money and resources. So while it sounds really, really obvious, make sure that you have a detailed list of all products and that you carefully verify and validate that any solution you're going to deploy matches up against that product set. Before we break for lunch, any questions or comments on patching service packs? Excellent. Excellent question. So David's question was, okay, Eric, you were talking about patches and the sensitivity, and you said the best way to secure a system is uninstall, remove the services, so you don't have to apply the patch. Do these third-party products actually check what services are running and only apply the patches that are needed, or do they just go in and push every patch out to every system? Most of the products that I'm familiar with, most of the products on the previous slide, they will check and only apply patches if those services are running. So they will actually do that discipline for you, and they will only give you the patches that are needed based on the current configuration build. So they will take care of that for you and not just blindly push out the patches. Great. So if there's no questions, let's break for lunch. It is 12:15, so we will come back at 1:30 We will finish up Windows. We will jump into Linux. And then we have a big lab at the end of the day. So because we want you to show you how to harden a box, today we just have one lab, but it's sort of a capstone lab that we're going to do at the end of the day, depending on how much time you want to spend with it. So we do have that lab coming at the very end. So enjoy your lunch, and then we'll start back up again at 1:30. So before lunch, we're talking about patching, and one of the key things we want to do is centralize patch management. The one thing I forgot to mention that I wanted to bring up, while there are many third-party patch management solutions out there, Microsoft does have their solution called WSUS, the Windows Server Update Services, and that is actually used a lot in different environments. We see it especially in a lot of oil and gas areas for managing and controlling patches within the environment. So while you absolutely can pay for a third-party solution, I did want to mention that Microsoft does have their free built-in solution, WSUS, that can also be used. The only thing to be aware of with WSUS is Microsoft solution only supports Microsoft products. What a surprise, right? They do not support third-party vendors. So in your pure play Windows environment, so if you have an area where you're just Windows in a controller supervisory area, WSUS can actually work very well. But if you're talking about areas where you have a lot of different vendors and equipment from other areas, that's where these third-party solutions often scale. And what we find is based on the size and diversity of environments that run control systems, it's not uncommon to actually have multiple different patch management solutions for different systems, different devices, and different areas in order to manage the unique needs of the business that you're running. So it doesn't just have to be one product. You can actually deploy different systems in different segments depending on the systems, the frequency, and the type of patches you need to roll out. Keeping a system as secure as possible to minimize the chances of it getting broken into are important. So patching, hardening, reducing the attack surface, applying service packs are all good, and it's all important. But the one comment that the gentleman made before lunch in the back was, we still have to back up our systems. We still have to recognize that no matter what we do, our systems might crash, and we do need to recognize that hardware doesn't last forever. And while we really try in control systems to do predictable failure of equipment and do excessive stress testing to try to replace equipment before bad things actually happen, we all know that sometimes bad things happen. Systems get hacked, things crash. So we want to make sure that we're backing up critical information in critical areas. So if something does occur, we can recover quickly. Now, the big problem I have in this area is most companies focus on the backup. They have backup procedures. They have backup methods. They have backup storage. Honestly, I don't care about the backup. What I want you to do is I want you to have recovery procedures, recovery methods, and test those methods, because recovery can only be done if you have backup, but backup can be done without recovery. And as we talked about before lunch, I've seen a lot of cases that where companies thought they were backing up and the system wasn't working and they didn't know it. I've seen incidents where I've had blank tapes and couldn't recover the systems. And I've had cases where companies have replaced their backup units and they didn't convert over their tapes. So they had no way of recovering the information to get the data back. So it's critical that we're focusing our energy and effort on recovery. Don't tell me you're backing up every night. When was the last time you stuck a tape in and recovered information? When was the last time you worked your staff through an entire recovery process? When was the last time you went in and actually recovered back a control system and had it fully functioning in your environment? That's where the focus needs to be, on the recovery, recovery, recovery. Backup is needed to get to recovery, but if you focus only on backup, you might not have the tools, methods, and means to recover in the quick, timely manner. And once again, there's lots of third-party solutions for backing up, storing, and protecting your information. It's also important to remember that when we're backing up information, it is only backing up the data. Do you realize if you delete files off the system, they are not being backed up? You're only backing up the active files. Further, do you realize if you delete information and empty the recycle bin in Windows, the data is still on the hard drive? Windows is not actually deleting the information. It's just marking it as free space, but the information is still on the system. Let me briefly show you what this looks like. So we have our file system, and we have file one, file two, and this points to a location on the hard drive where our data is located. So when we're doing most of our backups, this is what's being backed up. Now, in Windows, when you go in and you delete a file, all it's doing is removing it from this list and moving it to a second list called the recycle bin. Then, when you empty the recycle bin, all it's doing is taking a pointer and pointing it to a new area called free space. However, when you delete a file and empty recycle bin, it's moving the pointer. The data is still there. Microsoft does nothing to remove that information. So if you now go in and you do what's called a binary or a forensic backup on the system, it will be able to recover any deleted information off that box. Now, of course, the data is still on the hard drive, but it's marked as free space. So if you start writing large amounts of information to the hard drive, there's always the potential that it could overwrite that free space and be able to remove that information. But if you delete, or an adversary deletes, or somebody else deletes information, and you can get a binary backup before any other information or data has been written to that drive, you can actually recover the deleted information off that system. So we just always have to remember that, both for good and bad, if you have very sensitive information on a system and you're just deleting it, that data is still recoverable. The good news is if an adversary goes in and deletes information, we can also recover it off our box. So we would use binary backup tools like either DD or Ghost in order to be able to recover and get that information back off the system. This is also important to remember if you accidentally delete information. Back in January of this year, we were teaching a conference, and we had a new conference manager. And new conference managers always go around and take pictures of the facility to send them back to the SANS execs so they can see and understand the venue and make sure it's appropriate. So she took a bunch of pictures on her personal camera, and she went to delete some of the bad pictures, and she accidentally did delete all, and she deleted over 2,000 personal pictures, including pictures of her kids' wedding, the birth of her grandchildren, and many other special events. So I walk in the speaker room, and she's almost in tears. She lost 3 years worth of memories, pictures, and stuff she really wanted. I said, "Stop crying, give me the camera." I went in the other room, I came back 10 minutes later, I said, "Here's your pictures again." Because it was a Windows-based phone that she took the pictures with, and I knew when she deleted the file, my first question to her was, "Did you do anything? Did you start writing or doing anything else?" She said, "No." I'm like, "Perfect." I literally just went into the file system, and all the files were there. Microsoft just puts a question mark over the first letter. So I literally just had to replace the letter back with the name of the file, replace that real quickly for her 3,000 pictures. I had a little script that wrote it, and in 10 minutes was able to recover all the data off that hard drive. So that's an example where she thought she lost those pictures forever, and all she did was lost the link. I just had to go in and relink it back to the active file as opposed to the free space, and you could recover that information very, very quickly. Now, remember, though, I could give you the same story where I was working on criminal investigations where a criminal went in, and as law enforcement was coming into his building, he deleted his entire hard drive, thinking he was removing all the evidence, and I did the same thing. In 20 minutes, I recovered all the data, and we were able to present it back in court. So it can work both good and bad, depending on which size. But I just want to make sure you fully recognize that in Windows operating systems, when you're deleting information, you're not deleting information. You're removing pointers to the information. But with binary imaging tools, you can still get back all of that data and information. So now that we've gone in, we've looked at keeping our systems up to date from a patching and service pack perspective, and we've talked about backing up data recovery and the fact that information is actually not removed off the system. Before we move on to enforcing security policies, are there any questions, comments, or concerns? Hopefully you recognize that it is getting a little warmer. We recognize it got very, very cold in here. We were going to actually take shifts of passing around the projector because it's blowing out warm air, but it seems that we got it a little warmer. The real trick is, hypothetically, Mike and I, we had a little showdown. We wanted to see who had better skills, so we had to hotel make the room really cold to see which one can hack the HVAC system faster than the others. So because it's being recorded, and I want plausible deniability, I have a 50-50 chance. So now you figure out which one of us went in and fixed it for you, and we'll leave it at that. Excellent question. When we're backing up active databases that are actively being written to, like a historian or other files, does it require that you actually stop the database in order to be able to make that backup? Short answer is no. There are specialized backup tools for databases that will actually take a snapshot of the current instance and then back that up without actually stopping the database. It typically does require specialized backup tools, because if you're just using a standard backup capability and the files are being altered as you're backing it up, it could lead to either corrupting the database or corrupting your backup image. So you would need specialized backup tools to do that, but there are ways that you can do that without having to stop the database. Now remember, you're typically going to miss a few minutes of it, so it'll be about 5 to 10 minutes off, but still, if you're doing it once a day, that's acceptable to have that, so you can absolutely do that. However, if you're talking about a binary image of the hard drive, binary images can only be done if you boot it off of a kernel that's not on the hard drive that you're imaging. So you cannot do a binary image of a running system. You would actually have to go in and boot off an alternative media and boot the kernel off of a USB or DVD in order to be able to go in and take a binary image of that hard drive. So if you're talking about a binary image, you would have to not only stop but reboot the entire system to do that. But if you're talking just a backup of the active database, you can do that with current tools. One of the big things that we want to do in all environments, including control systems, is be able to enforce a uniform security policy across the enterprise. The way we do that in Windows is with something called a security template. A security template is an ASCII file that has a .inf extension, and essentially it sets the parameters of how you want to configure or secure a given system. So security templates at the highest level contain two things. They contain settings and they contain permissions. So I can go into my template and I can have a list of security settings and I can have a list of permissions that I can use for configuring and securing my box. Now, I find examples are a very helpful way to understand what we're talking about. So let's go in and let's look at an example of a security template. A semicolon is a comment, and here we go. Your minimum password age is 2. Your maximum password age is 42. Your length is 8. So those are examples of security settings. Then if we scroll down, here we have permissions listed on the system. So we could have a list of permissions, and we can have a list of security settings, and literally we can take this template and we can apply it to a system to be able to control how it's configured and set from a security perspective. Now, the important thing to remember about a security template is you can put as much or as little information as you want. So that can be my entire template. If I just want to go in and I want to change my password policy on my system, that can be my entire template. So it's not like a template has 87 fields that must always be filled out. You can have 3, you can have 50, you can have 5,000. So these templates can contain as much or as little information as you want. And what's nice about that is you can actually do what we call configuration management with customized builds. What I'm referring to is often you want to be able to know how every system is configured, and you want to be able to validate all the security settings on the box. The problem, you're not going to have 5,000 servers that are all configured identical. Each one's going to have a specialized purpose. So here's what we do. I create a baseline corporate security template, and that gets applied to every server. So all 5,000 servers get the same base corporate template. Then I have different templates for each location. So then I have a template for location A, B, and C. So then all the location A's would get a location A template added on to the corporate template. Then for location A, I would have another template for HMIs. I would have another template for control servers. I'd have another template for historians. So now all my systems are built in a standardized way. But by doing multiple templates layered on top of each other, I can have customized builds. But now it's verifiable because I know all my systems are at the base level. All of the A's have this on top of it. The historians are this way. The controllers are this way. And the HMIs are configured in that manner. So by using multiple layers of templates, you can get customized configuration management that can be verified and scaled. And we find that that works extremely well in control systems, because you need to be able to have consistency but uniqueness in how your servers are set up, managed, and controlled. Security templates are not only great for configuration control, they're also great for securing complex areas of the system. What is one of the areas in Windows that often has a lot of issues that we want to be able to secure, but it's very, very large in terms of the parameters that have to be controlled? The registry. The registry is the brains of your computer, and the permissions are often not set correctly in the registry. Problem? There's 98,000 registry settings. How many of you would like to go in and manually change the permissions on 98,000 settings on 4,000 servers? I'm disappointed. When I taught this in Herndon, Graham raised his hand. I guess he tried it and he no longer wants to do that anymore. Okay. As long as it's hourly. Okay. He won't do fixed rate, but he'll do hourly work. Excellent. I like how you're thinking there. So definitely not scalable in any organization. But guess what? What if I go in and I have a template that has all of the permissions for those 98,000 keys? Now, literally, I just take the one file and I just apply it across the board. So templates are not only good for verifiable configuration management, but they're also good to accomplish very mundane, time-consuming tasks that need to be done in order to lock down our environment. And we use templates a lot when it comes to registry permissions and controls. So here's another example of your template where it gives you the different parameters that are in place on the system. You can technically edit templates in an ASCII editor like I just showed you. The problem is it's error prone. If I go back here and I want to edit these files and I'm not paying attention, what can happen? Invalid value, and that's not going to work within the environment. So while I can bring it up in an editor, that's not typically how we want to edit these files. We want to go in, and there's something built into Windows called the MMC, which is the Microsoft Management Console. It's a generic GUI where you can go in and load your own unique components. So there actually is a security template editor and a security configuration tool. And now if I go in to the template tool, now it's structured based on the layout for local group policies. And now when I go and click on password age, now if I try to enter in something silly, it won't let me. It has built-in error checking. And if I hit explain, it will actually tell me the values, the reason, and the analysis. So this is automatically built in. You don't have to install anything. By default, if you bring up Windows now and type MMC and go to Security Template, it's built in. And this is a much more user-friendly way for editing and managing templates within your environment. Now, when we look at this slide, you don't typically want to ever build a template from scratch. Actually, there is only one reason and one reason alone why you would ever pull up an editor and manually create a template from scratch. The only reason why you would ever do that is to torture the interns. Other than that, we would never ever want to go in and start from scratch. So unless you just want to be mean, right? We're not going to do that because there's so many templates out there, and Microsoft and many other organizations have created so many that you might as well just use the ones that are out there. Find one that's about 85 to 90% of what you need and then customize it. That's a much more effective way of handling it. And what's nice is if we go in and look at Microsoft has their Security Compliant Manager Kit, essentially this is a tool where you can select what security options you want and it will recommend a template for you. It will recommend what template you should roll out or deploy in your environment. Now, the way I usually recommend it to my students is there's two ways I would have you start with templates. Most of you are going to be in one of two categories. Category one, you know what you want to do. You know what the parameters are. You just need a base template to add them to. The second group of students are ones who have no idea what they want, but they want a menu of all possible settings that can be put in a template. Depending on which group you are, I'll give you different advice. If you're in the first group, if you know what you want to do, you just need a base template to add it to, you would use the EC template. The EC or Enterprise Client template is a base template that's not going to break anything. It has the core security requirements, and then you would just add your parameters onto that. So if you know what you want to do, you would take the Enterprise Client template, add to it, and deploy that in your environment. If you're in the second group where you have no idea what's available and you want an entire menu of all possible settings, that's your SSLF. Your SSLF is your specialized security, limited functionality, and this is a template that has every possible security option available. And then you would go through and pick and choose which options you want and which options you don't want. Important, you would never, ever deploy SSLF on a system. Let me help you out here. Specialized security means every possible security option on the planet, and limited functionality means your system won't boot. There is such a thing as overly securing your system. if you apply SSLF to your system, it will be so secure, it will turn off the GUI, it will turn off the logon, and literally your system will boot and just hang, and you won't be able to do anything. So you never, ever want to go in and run SSLF. It is merely a comprehensive listing of all security options, so you can pick and choose, but you would never, ever just blindly apply it on the system, because it will actually stop the system from functioning correctly. So great. I got this template. I got my settings and permissions. I have it verified. What do I do with it? Well, there's a couple things. One is you can go in, and within the MMC, there is a tool called SCA, the Security Configuration and Analysis Tool. So if you go in and we open up a database, you can see all the lovely places I've been this year. Okay, that doesn't sound good. Mike, stop hacking the systems. Enough's enough. Then we go in and we can pick one of our templates. And then once it's loaded, I can now analyze my system or configure my system. Analyze will just go in and compare my system against the template. It won't make any changes. Configure will actually change your system. Because you should never change your system without testing it, I'm not going to change it. I'm going to just analyze. And now it gives the same structure as before, except now you have two columns. You have your database, which is the template, and you have your computer, and it's going to tell you whether they match. Important, these checks and X's are not a best fit. They're an exact match. If these two values are the same, it's a check. If these two values are different, it's an X. I had a student run this once, and they called me over and says, Eric, the template says my password length should be 10 characters. My system has 15 characters. Why did I get an X? 15 is better than 10. I should get a check. I said, no. It's not a best fit in this exact match. Because 10 and 15 don't match, it gave you an X. So therefore, when you're analyzing your system, X is not bad. X just means different. You might get X's because your system is more secure, or you might get X's because your system is less secure, but all it's saying is the values are not the same. So if you run this on a box and you get X's, don't necessarily assume your system is vulnerable. It might mean your system is just more secure than how the template is actually set up and configured. In terms of these last two bullets, they are true, but they're not the truth. Yes, in SCA, there is no undo feature. So if you go in and you make a mistake, you're stuck. However, in Windows, there is an undo feature. It's called restore points. So what you can do is whenever I run SCA, I snap a restore point at the OS level. Then if SCA screws up my system, I can use restore points to restore back to the previous version. So yes, SCA doesn't have an undo feature, but Windows does call restore points, so we can get around that deficiency. Last bullet. True, with SCA, you cannot run templates across the network. SCA only runs on your local computer, and you cannot scale it across an enterprise. However, SecEdit, which is the command line version of SCA, can absolutely be pushed and run across your network. And even better, if you have a security template and you want to apply it across your network after testing, you can put security templates directly in group policy objects. So if I just want to apply this template across the enterprise, I just import in a security template right into a GPO group policy object, and that could push it out across the network. If I want to analyze my systems to see how they're different than a template, I can't do that directly with GPOs, but I can write a SecEdit script, drop SecEdit into GPO, and use that to analyze my system. So while SCA only runs locally, security templates and SecEdit can absolutely be pushed out and rolled out across the environment. When we talk about group policy, there's really two levels we operate at. Local group policy, which applies to the system, and domain group policy, which applies to all systems within a domain. So on local group policy, we can go in and apply scripts to the computer and scripts to the user. Now, I use this when I travel. And the reason is, when I'm logged in to my computer and I'm plugged into my corporate network at my company, I'm plugged in at my home network, and I'm plugged in a wireless network at a network security conference. Is it the same risk in all three areas? No, it's quite different exposures. So when I'm on my corporate network, I want to have different access and different control than when I'm traveling abroad. So what I actually do is I actually have three user accounts on my computer. I have Eric W for Eric Work, Eric H for Eric Home, and Eric T for Eric Travel. So now when I'm at work, I log in as Eric W. When I'm at this hotel, I log in as Eric T. And then each one has specialized user group policy objects that run that lock down, configure, and protect my system differently. When I go in and log in as Eric T for Eric Travel, literally everything is totally and completely locked down. And the only thing I can do is set up a VPN back to my company. That's it. When I log in as Eric W, I can do just about anything because I know I'm on a trusted network behind firewalls, IDS, IPS, and other devices. So that's just a trick where you can go in and almost set up multiple personalities for the system and how it behaves or operates differently. We use that with a lot of our utility clients because it's not uncommon in control centers to have different people logging in for different purposes into the same computer. And one of the issues we used to have is a lot of our clients used to love to use shared accounts. And shared accounts are a nightmare for several reasons. One, no accountability. You don't know who did it. Shared passwords get to be known by more folks. And you can't give the granularity of access that you need. So now we can set up different profiles where when users log into the same computer, we can reconfigure the computer so it can act in a different manner based on the access control and methods that's required for your job function. So we can utilize local group policy objects to achieve that flexibility and scalability across our systems. Now, when we talk about going in and having local group policy objects for the computer and for the user, it's really more granular than that. For the computer, we have two modes, starting up your system and shutting down your system. For the user, we have two modes, logging on and logging off. So the way it works is when you turn your computer on, the computer startup local GPO runs. Then when you log on, the user log on runs, then log off, then shut down. So essentially the order in which they're going to run is startup, log on, log off, shutdown are going to be the way the four work. The startup and shutdown are tied to the computer, and the log on and log off are tied to the unique user account that's logging in to that specific system. And then your GPOs are nothing more than complex scripts that you can set up and configure to run when that specific event occurs, starting up the computer, logging in, logging off, or shutting down your desired device. Now, local GPOs are nice because they run just on that system. Domain GPOs run across your entire domain. Domain GPOs are what I call nuclear-grade security. And the reason I refer to it, it's like nuclear energy. Nuclear energy can be a very powerful, clean method of providing electricity to a large population. nuclear energy can also be very devastating if it's put in a weapon. So nuclear power in the right hands can be very, very powerful, and in the wrong hands can be very, very devastating. That's a domain GPO. Domain GPOs let me 100% hands-free change and alter 90,000 systems in my network. Literally, with the domain GPO, I can change every box in my network, which means in the hands of a skilled operator, when there's a vulnerability or exposure, I could secure 90,000 systems like that. In the hands of an ill-informed or misinformed or adversary, they can take down, destroy, or wipe out your entire network like that. I have seen cases where companies have very effectively rolled out and utilized domain GPOs, and I've also seen cases where companies created incorrect domain objects and actually took down, devastated, and paralyzed their entire environment. So just be super careful with domain GPOs. They are a great tool. They're a quick, efficient way of reconfiguring and securing your environment, but they could also be very, very dangerous and devastating. What you want to do is you want to go in and take your domain and break it up into subdomains. If you have 80,000 devices on your domain, you don't ever want to have one domain GPO hit 80,000 boxes. That's way too risky. What you want to do is take your domain and break it up into subdomains. The way we break up a domain into subdomains is called OUs. OUs are object units, which are smaller subsections. So now, if you have 80,000 devices in your network, you might go in and break it up into 16 OUs, where each OU has 5,000 systems. So now I call it the scope of devastation is now 5,000 systems instead 80,000.